Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at fff.org. For Pacifica Radio, February 22nd, 2013, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is scotthorton.org. And you can find all my interview archives there, more than 2,700 of them, going back to 2003. You can also find me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. Tonight's guest is Patrick Coburn. He is Middle Eastern correspondent for The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. Of course, he writes for counterpunch.org. Three brand new articles there we'll be talking about tonight. And he's the author of the book, most recently, of the book Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival, and the Struggle for Iraq. And as I was mentioning, there's three new Counterpunch articles, all of them about his recent trip back to Iraq. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us tonight. And so you've been, you took a trip to Iraq for what, 2 or 3 weeks there?
Yeah, I was there for about 3 weeks. All over the place, really, in Baghdad, in Basra, up and down the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and in Kurdistan as well.
Okay, and so I guess, first of all, since it is 10 years, so just without having to catch us up on what's happened in the last 10 years, what's it like there, say, in Baghdad 10 years later?
It's pretty bad. I mean, I was kind of shocked how bad it was. First of all, not much has changed. You know, I think that maybe, I don't know what Iraqi oil revenues have been collectively over the last 10 years, but let's say, you know, $500 billion. But there's scarcely a new building. It all looks very shabby. You know, electricity, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. There was some rainfall the first day or two I was there, which should drain away because a lot of money's been spent on a new sewage system, except somehow there isn't a new sewage system, so you've got great pools of water and sewage in the streets. I mean, Iraqis find this pretty infuriating, that 10 years after the war, they still can't live a normal life.
Yeah, I mean, even just the basics of electricity, I remember it was sort of a matter of concern even back in 2004 and 5 that, geez, you can't get the electricity on yet. It seems like the occupation is failing. Now, you're telling me the same story in 2013.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, it's grand theft. It's embezzlement. And also a sort of dysfunctional government, you know, that even if they can produce the power, they don't have the, they couldn't really distribute it. Or people in the electricity ministry told me. So, you know, things are a bit better in terms of violence compared to 2006 to 7, but then we were getting 3,000 bodies a week, a month turning up. Now, these days, you know, there are bombings in Kirkuk, bombings in Sadr City, there are assassinations, there are kidnappings. You know, it's still one of the more dangerous places in the world, but I could say, you could say it's a bit better than it was 5 years ago.
Mm. Now, in a way, I guess from a certain point of view, really the American mission, whether they realized this in the first place or not, was ultimately to put the Shiite coalition in power and then get kicked out. And so the Sunnis, basically, after getting kicked out of Baghdad back in 2006 and 7, that was when they worked out the deal with the Americans to stop fighting for a while, and then but they made the deal that eventually they would be kind of subsumed within the government, given army jobs, given work, included in, you know, more in the government. And so has that happened?
It hasn't, and it's very relevant because the Sunnis are all, in the streets at the moment in Ramadi and Fallujah and Mosul in Tikrit. that's demanding an end to discrimination. I mean, at that time, as you rightly say, they sort of decided that they couldn't fight the Shia and the Americans at the same time, so they did a deal with the Americans. They never stopped attacking the Shia, blowing up laborers in the markets or attacking government facilities. But they never really got all the jobs they expected. Now they are launching a sort of offensive of their own. And it's critical to the future of Iraq what happens. Are we going to see a new sort of Syria-type situation occur in western Iraq where the Sunni are dominant? Are we going to see an intervention by outside Sunni powers like Saudi Arabia or Qatar or Turkey? So the crisis is getting hotter and hotter there. There was a sort of stability between about 2008 and 2011. But the sort of consensus between Kurds and Shia and Sunni has broken down. There's more and more animosity between the leaders. They're not on speaking terms. So, you know, the situation is sort of going critical at a time when I think the outside world really sort of stopped looking at what was happening in Iraq. You know, there are very few foreign journalists around. There's very little reporting of what happens there.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Maliki, it sounds like, you know, from what I read, the prime minister has done a good job, from his point of view, of trying to put himself in charge of all the different departments and consolidate all that kind of thing. But just in terms of raw power, he doesn't have that much, right? Like, he's as unable to really take over, say, the Anbar province as the Anbar province is able to take over Baghdad at this point, right? So why doesn't he make some friends and work out some compromise? Wouldn't that be to his benefit for his own power and influence and his longevity and power, et cetera, like that?
I mean, that's probably right, but it's sort of a mistake that everybody seems to make who is dominant, at least for a time in Iraq. I mean, Saddam Hussein thought you could run Iraq by force. The U.S. occupation, the U.S. Army, thought it could do the same thing. They both failed. And the reason they failed is there are too many other power centers. You know, it's really a serious business to take on the Shia community and or the Sunni community or the Kurdish community. Even if you've got a powerful army, the other side is probably going to fight a good deal harder than you do, and your own forces may dissolve. For the moment, the government seems to be underestimating what's happening in Anbar province, seems to think that, you know, they can wait it out, they can buy off some tribal leaders, they can make a few concessions, and then nothing much will change. They might be right, but I doubt it. I think things really are changing because the Sunni feel emboldened because of Syria and other regional changes. And also they're just fed up. They're fed up because they feel discriminated against. They're fed up because all Iraqis are basically fed up because they wonder where all this money is going and why, you know, summer is coming on. It's real hot in Iraq. And they won't have any electricity for the air conditioners. So, they're real angry and they're real disillusioned. And that applies to Shia as much as well as Sunni.
Mm-hmm. And now, it's interesting what you say about they kind of feel... the wind blowing in their direction in a way, you write in Counterpunch, because of the war in Syria, as you just mentioned, that the rebels in Syria, I guess they're not necessarily winning, but they have made some big gains, and that's kind of put the fight back in the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq, basically.
Yeah, because a lot of those fighting in Syria actually came from Iraq, although they may have originally come from Syria. That's probably where the most experienced fighters come from. Mm-hmm. And also, it's a big common border. You know, there are tribes, there are people who cross that border, who live on the border. They don't feel there's much difference on which side of the border they're fighting. So, you know, I don't think this thing is going to go away, whatever the government in Baghdad thinks. And maybe there won't be an immediate crisis. But all the time, the sort of center of gravity is going up in the government, and you know it's very vulnerable to any sudden shock. It doesn't have too many friends around. It's very unpopular.
Mm-hmm. Well, now it's interesting that you say that. I remember an article from probably last summer, where a rebel in Syria, one of the al-Nusra Front guys, I guess, was explaining that he sort of was conceding, I think, that maybe we won't be able to take Damascus. We might have to settle for basically just trying to break a piece of Syria off. And he was saying, I'm paraphrasing, that we'll just create a new Sunni stan with former Sunni Iraq. And we'll just make a new country there. Who needs Maliki and who needs Damascus? We'll just make our own new country right here in the middle.
Yeah, I think like Maliki may be underestimating the Sunni. The Sunni may be underestimating the Shia. I think if they try for regime change, if they try to reverse what was really the sort of verdict of the fighting after 2003, the civil war, then the Shia will fight real hard. And there are a lot more of them in Iraq than there are Sunni, about 3-1. So I think if the Sunni kind of overplayed their hand at that time, they might overdo it again. If they're more cautious, if they look for allies in Iraq, if they demand reform rather than revolution, if they don't frighten the Shia and the Kurds too much, then they might go a long way. But if the Shia feel that this is a counter-revolution, then they'll all line up with Maliki and fight real hard. And they're the backbone of the army these days, so there's a lot they can do. I don't think they can long-term hold the whole of all Sunni areas, but if they feel under threat, then they're going to fight, very hard.
I'm Scott Horton. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Patrick Coburn from The Independent. And you know, it's interesting, too, that the Americans, it seems like, and correct me if I'm oversimplifying too much here, but America seems to be backing the Sunni-based insurgency from Iraq in Syria right now, and they're mad at Maliki, their former friend who they put in power in Iraq, for helping the Iranians arm Bashar al-Assad, who they're working on regime changing.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing that, but on the other hand, they don't want Maliki to go down. So, you know, they're involved in a very sort of complicated situation. I mean, they also obviously wonder, you know, who's going to replace Assad? Supposing their guys win, is it in fact their guys or is it the al-Nusra Front? Is it the same al-Qaeda that was supposedly fighting the U.S. Army in western Iraq that suddenly are going to be among the big new players in Damascus? That isn't great news for them. So I think they sort of don't really know what to do. They're going to arm the rebels, but which rebels are they going to arm? You know, who's going to replace Assad? And what's the effect going to be on Iraq? They don't really know the answer to these questions.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the discussion on the Sunday morning news shows or whatever, where these pretend smart people say, you know, well, if we arm the moderates, then they'll be the ones who win, and then we can be happy with that. But it doesn't seem like anyone intelligent or with the actual power, it doesn't seem like Obama really believes that. And yet, they just keep financing them anyway. It doesn't seem like they're giving them all the weapons they could be giving them, but they're certainly helping the rebellion in Syria this whole time, right?
Yeah, and I mean, they're helping, but their guys, so to speak, are maybe making some advances, but they're not winning, you know. You know, we'll see what happens. You know, I think that they're tempted to sort of to arm them to go for a military victory. And, you know, it's noticeable that the rebels just don't want to talk, that they're sort of, they think that ultimately the U.S. and the Europeans and Saudi Arabia will back them for a military victory. And so every 5 minutes, the opposition say, we won't talk to Bashar al-Assad, we'll talk to somebody else. But why should Assad sort of give up when he still holds all the cities of Syria? The opposition haven't been able to take a single city yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've made some inroads, but they haven't captured a single city. And there hasn't been a sort of mass defection from the regime. You know, there have been individuals that have gone over, but there haven't been battalions that have changed sides or senior generals who've changed sides with their troops. So it's the regime communists are showing some signs of coherence. So, you know, that's the ingredients for a stalemate at the moment. That might change, but that's the present situation.
Yeah, the Americans are afraid to help them really win, but they do say, they basically agree with the rebels, right, the Obama administration, that, oh, we certainly don't insist that you talk to Assad. You shouldn't talk to Assad. Assad's days are numbered and finished and all of these kinds of things. So the rebels are have reason to hold out for American full-fledged help, whether it's really coming or not, right?
Yeah, I mean, Hillary Clinton and people were saying things like that, you know, and John McCain and so forth. But as soon as you say we aren't talking to our side, then you're not talking because there's nobody else to talk to. You know, they say we'll talk to moderates in the regime. Who are these moderates, you know? Assad is the boss there, and he, you know, as I said, things maybe got a little bit worse for him, but he's by no means losing yet, and he may well think that he can last this out. So basically, he's got to... you know, he doesn't want to compromise, and there's nobody to compromise with.
Hmm. All right, now back to Iraq. There are parliamentary elections, right? Nationwide elections coming up in April. Do you expect much of a change in coalition power?
There'll be local elections in April, then parliamentary ones next year. It's difficult to know. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I was all over southern Iraq. Last time round, we had the government was, Maliki was having an offensive against the Sadrists who are kind of on the run. So in areas that they're powerful, they didn't have that number of representatives. This time they'll do better. How will Maliki do? You know, he's very unpopular among sort of the political class, or the leadership of the Kurds, the religious leadership of the Shia. But maybe the Shia as a whole, the voters will feel they're under pressure from the Sunni and... they should rally behind that boy. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, that's quite interesting. Then we have parliamentary elections sort of next year. And, you know, at the moment, Maliki's in a funny position, but in some way he's deep destabilized by what's happening in Syria because that's emboldened the Iraqi Sunni to be tougher, to protest. But at the same time, one of his main backers is Iran, and Iran doesn't want him to... another crisis in Iraq at the moment when they've got a crisis in Syria and a crisis in relations over sanctions and nuclear weapons, nuclear enrichments and so forth. So they'll back Maliki, or they're telling people they'll back Maliki for the moment, but will they back him beyond this year? Will they back him beyond the parliamentary elections? And that seems to be up in the air. It's not clear yet. For the moment, though, they want to support him, but they don't want to see him go down at this moment and produce another crisis in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, does he have enough actual authority on a day-to-day level where he could cancel election results and just make himself Saddam for life?
No, it couldn't be done. There are too many enemies. You know, it's sort of, there is an electoral system. It doesn't work very well and so forth, but he just doesn't really have the strength to do that. He might have a go, but I doubt it. You know, he sort of behaves. You take the last election in 2000, parliamentary election 2010. Mm. I mean, his coalition got about 24% of the vote. He got about sort of just under 3 million votes, and there are about, you know, 19 million registered voters in Iraq. It isn't that high a proportion of the population. But he sort of ruled as if he had a tremendous mandate from the voters, which just isn't there. And he needed kind of to maintain a consensus. And he's done the opposite. But I doubt if he has the strength to sort of go for a dictatorship and just stop having elections at all.
And now, so do you think that in the near future you'll have a reorientation where maybe the Sadrists will ally with the Sunnis and really make a Iraqi nationalist coalition and freeze out the Dawah Party guys?
I think there'll be some parallel attacks on Maliki. I mean, that's just kind of his strength, that he has lots of enemies, but the enemies plural. And they don't like him, but they don't like each other much. They're suspicious of him. Mukhtar has been saying, you know, good things about the Sunni. He's attacked Maliki for giving the impression that the Shia want to dominate everybody else. But, you know, for a lot of Sunni are still very suspicious of him, you know, seeing him as Mukhtar, the sort of Sunni killer, the Mahdi army, playing a prominent, the most prominent role in the civil war in 2006 and 7. So all these people are pretty suspicious of each other. And there's, you know, there's blood between them. There's blood between the Sunni and the Kurds, and between the Sunni and the Shia. It's difficult for this to be forgotten. And Maliki can exploit this. He also has a lot of money. He has a lot of jobs, about 3 million jobs. He has there aren't many jobs in Iraq. He has a lot of things going for him. It's not enough to run the country by force, but it's enough to fight a battle, a political battle. I mean, well, one sort of leading Sadrist made a point to me that that all the factions are strong. They all have reasons for strength, the Sunni, Maliki, the Kurds, the Shia, the Sadrists. So nobody has a pressing reason for compromise. And that's why this crisis might go on for a long time.
Yeah, it sounds like the country really is de facto split apart like Joe Biden wanted all along, right?
It is, but the background to all this is deep dissatisfaction over the fact that the place is so impoverished, you know. You get us down in Basra, you know, and Basra is in the center of about 70% of Iraqi oil production, some of the greatest oil fields in the world. But you drive around the poorer parts of Basra and you see heaps of uncollected garbage and herds of goats sort of eating, living on the garbage. You see sort of pools of sewage. You know, what happened to all the money is what Iraqis ask. You know, this is a very sort of dysfunctional government, you know, massive corruption, embezzlement, government thwarting any attempts to monitor or suppress this. So people are really real angry about this. You know, the whole country is full of young men who don't have jobs. I was talking to one professor at a college in Baghdad, and he was saying, you know, come to my class and ask people what they want to do, and 95% will say they want to leave Iraq. He said, but if they could get jobs, only about 2% of them would want to leave Iraq. You know, it's really simple that you have a very bad government stealing a lot of money, and people are suffering a lot.
Well, and now you also said you went up to Kurdistan, and you write in Counterpunch that things look a lot better in Kirkuk than they did 10 years ago. That was for sure.
Yeah, I mean, things are better up there. You know, there's an oil boom. You have a single sort of government authority. Security is better. I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of, it's kind of boomtown atmosphere. At the same time, you know, what I was thinking when I was there was it reminds me a lot of Ireland about before the crash of 2008, you know, when the Celtic Tiger was bounding along, when people were saying good things about the Irish economy. Mm-hmm. The Irish felt that, you know, finally, you know, they'd achieved economic prosperity forever. And then, whoops, the whole thing sort of blew up. You know, it all turned out to be, you know, not just a boom, but a bubble. And there's slightly the same atmosphere in Kurdistan. It's a very vulnerable place, you know. You can be in Erbil in a sort of fancy hotel, but a few miles away in Mosul, you know, at the same time as I was there, you know, they assassinated the head of a general in charge of intelligence. You know, there were bombs down in Kirkuk, another few not very far away. And the whole, you know, Iraq, Kurdistan is pretty corrupt too. But it does have a single government in charge, and security is quite good, and things like electricity work much better than Baghdad. But it's not. They try to present themselves as the other Iraq, completely different from Baghdad. But actually, an awful lot of things are bad in Baghdad and bad in Kurdistan as well.
Yeah. Well, they've been mostly spared in the last two wars, although I guess there's kind of been a low-level war, especially for Kirkuk, going on, especially the last 10 years, yeah?
Yeah, there's lots of sort of tension. I mean, and this is getting worse. You know, it's sort of rather bizarre that the Kurds are part of the government, but at the same time, they last year the government was massing troops, threatening to invade areas disputed with the Kurds. The Kurds were doing the same thing with their army, and they were practically at war. So there's strong reasons for keeping together. But there are strong reasons for confrontation as well.
And how significant is it that Talabani, the seeming, I guess, one of the two major Kurdish leaders, has now had a stroke and seemingly on his way out of power? Is that going to hurt things very much?
It makes a difference because he was president, but he was also, leader of one of the Kurdish movements, which he had, in a sense, his own private army. This made him pretty powerful, so he's difficult to replace. Secondly, he played a sort of mediating role of creating a consensus, and there's nobody really who can replace him there. So Maliki is the vice president is one of Maliki's people, has sort of taken over that source of authority for what it's worth. So and it doesn't look likely that Talabani will be back. He's he's been in hospital. As far as I know, he can't speak. Other late Kurdish leaders who went there weren't allowed to see him, but the doctors said he had to be allowed to recover. So, that does make a difference.
All right, Patrick. Well, it's great to talk to you again. Thank you very much for your time on the show tonight.
Thank you.
Everybody, that's Patrick Coburn from the London Independent. That's independent.co.uk. And he's got three new ones at counterpunch.org about his recent trip to all parts of Iraq. And he's, of course, get his book, Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival, and the Struggle for Iraq. And please, if you can, tomorrow, find time to go and support Bradley Manning. Go to bradleymanning.org for all the details about pro-Manning events in your town, marking 1,000 days for this American hero locked in prison without trial. bradleymanning.org. That's it for the show tonight. Anti-War Radio will be back here next Friday from 6:30 to 7 on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. You'll find all my interview archives at my website, scotthorton.org. See you then. Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. Hey, all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. You ought to consider advertising on the show. Here's how it'll work. You give me money, and then I'll tell everybody how great your stuff is. They'll buy it, and we'll all be rich as Republicans. Sound pretty good? Shoot me an email, scott@scotthorton.org, and we'll work it out. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.